minutes just to give a huge round of applause to these panelists. It is really tremendous to hear your candid, honest comments, understanding the issues of this enormity, this complex social problem, and also the reality of keeping it practical and pragmatic, and to have that balance. It's not just focusing on the offenders, but we also have to focus it on the victims and our community at hand. And we have to keep that balance and keep it in front of us and keep it safe. This part of the forum is to you. This part, Len Engel has a number of cards. If you have any other cards, we're going to bring them forward, and then I'll read them out. After that part, if we can get through all the questions, it's an open discussion. And just I'd like to ask for one basic house rule, and I call it the three-breath rule, is that great speeches have been done in this place, and that's not the time for today. If you have a comment, if you can say your comment, your question, your concern within three breaths, that's great. If you are a bagpiper, you get one. But again, to focus it, you know, to the question, whether it's to anybody on the panel, or we can open it up to the discussion. So, first question. What are the barriers to statewide systematic acceptance of evidence-based practices, including changing statutes that encumber the process, such as paneling, quote-unquote, those likely to succeed, low risk, and custodial and restrictions on some offenders with mandatory minimum sentencing guideline sentences? Will lead the change to change them in the what will lead them to change in the legislators? Did you understand that? Okay. And what will lead the change to change them in the legislator? And what will change them in the what will change the statutes in the legislature?
Well, I think what Gene and I confront on a daily basis is the belief, the widespread belief, that these mandatory minimums work. My own experience, both as a lawyer and a legislator, I don't think they do work, and I don't think you should take discretion away from judges in probation who heard the facts, know the individual, do a pre-sentencing report. But see, in politics, you know, it's the old keep it simple, stupid thing. You know, they just... And the plus, however, right now is we've got this fellow as a governor who wants to work and is very open-minded and not given to cliches and shibboleths, and he's a worker. And he's open, I think, to the idea that we shouldn't be having these mandatory minimums, that there are too many people in jail who don't belong in jail. And so legislatively, he and I... The committee that we chair is filled with issues that would put us on the front page every day of the week. We try not to, I guess we try to stay away from the media as best we can.
Or on the O'Reilly Show.
Oh, yeah, right. We try to stay away from that. It because it doesn't lend itself to solutions. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a big push now in this certain area to increase mandatory minimums in certain areas. I just don't think they work. So the answer is we try to keep it low-key, mm-hmm. Fly under the radar, and discourage that approach.
Any other responses, remarks? Back, yes.
Is there one of the things that happens under the transition from prison to community initiative model is that there is a statewide body which is composed of the key stakeholders, the collaborators that need to get together, and during that period of planning, one thing they need to identify are the legislative barriers, and they can begin to develop the rationale for why change is needed and begin to work with political leaders about the best ways to go about doing that. So I think there's a opportunity in the model that NIC developed for those kinds of plans to be developed. They're obviously going to play out differently in every state because the political climate, the political actors, et cetera, are different. But the approach, I think, needs to start in that high-level planning process.
Just real briefly, I think it's also important to note that there have been people like Sheriff Ash who 10 years ago, when I first heard the term reentry, have been doing it for years. And so there are centers of excellence in the Commonwealth that are going on right now, the work that John Larrabee is doing in bringing this to this conversation, I think is something that we have to recognize. So there are places where it's working, but it's usually the result of someone with a lot of foresight, like the sheriff.
What are the specific next steps for our state agencies to begin this collaborative plan mentioned? And it goes up further. For our legislators to receive and change certain laws that add to this problem, and for district attorneys, judges, probation, and parole, is client appropriate cases, standardized guidelines of practice, particularly for substance abuse and mental health issues? So, well,
again, encouraging legislation which would, in terms of the reentry problem, encourage better supervision, especially in the areas of folks who have, and I can tell you from my own practice, most of them have a substance abuse problem that contributed to what put them in jail in the first place. So when they reenter society, supervision, number one. But number two, we're overlooking the most important thing, and I think that's jobs. We almost need, and this is not just a state problem, it's a national problem, we almost need a WPA there are certain public works projects which go undone. The state and the cities and towns don't have the workers to do that work. With a comprehensive approach, which includes state and federal government, a reinstitution is kind of a WPA sort of thing, because you can develop skills and Corey's won't affect you from those kinds of jobs. I mean, you just wouldn't believe the number of young folks who don't have jobs. And you know, there's a certain amount of personal pride when you get a piece of paper at the end of the week that says, pay the order of me, because I put in 37.5 hours of work. And I think it's the government's job to fill that niche. I think there's a study that came out in the Globe this week about the Army wasn't letting kids in who had records, and they've started to allow them in now. And it turns out that a lot of the kids who are problematic, their retention rate in the service is higher because they get introduced to order and discipline. And the first time in their life, they've got three squares, a roof over their head, and some purpose in life. So again, we have to rethink a lot of that legislation on the federal and state level, which inhibited folks from mainstreaming again.
Very good. Please.
On a services level, I'm always optimistic, but the president passed the Second Chance Offender Reentry Act recently, and part of what was contained in that legislation, largely as a result of the state substance abuse directors pushing for it, was a provision around mental health and substance abuse services. And I actually think with some of the leadership that we have through the governor's office, through this strong association of our secretaries, and through folks up here, that we can be well-positioned, I think, in focusing not just on mental health and substance abuse services, but the rest of the service package that has to go along with it. That legislation, at this point, is yet unfunded. So I think we have an opportunity to work with our legislative delegation in terms of appropriately funding that piece of legislation.
Fantastic. Please.
Yes, Tom. I just see a couple areas here that have proven to be successful that we could devote some time to. Certainly the day reporting system, and certainly the senator touched upon the word concentrated or intense aspect. And we've had this in place since 1986, and we've had thousands of inmates that have gone through it. And just what the senator is saying, that it has been intense, meaning that beyond the electronic monitoring, the itinerary that has to be put together in collaboration with the Sheriff's Department staff and the reporting each day to the center, exploring jobs, in other words, working with him very, very intensely. And I'm just using that word intensely or targeted and concentrated and to my way of thinking, I would love to see, which we now have some legislation that is in committee, something like that to be energized and looked at. Because to me, it's on one hand, we're looking at $45,000 a year versus, you know, $10,000 a year, you know, in terms of this. But the point being, putting aside money, it works. It's successful. And it works well with you're working well with agencies in terms of jobs and all these kind of things, and just makes so much sense. The other thing is, again, our partnership on the drug and alcohol treatment modality. And again, we have the Western Massachusetts Correctional Alcohol Center that's been in place since 1985. And again, I remember when we first looked at trying to site that facility and, quote, just place driving under the influence on the third offense at this particular facility. I remember the outcry, just as the senators and representative touched upon, not my backyard kind of syndrome. And, excuse me. And, but again, since 1985, it's just been tremendously successful in terms of treatment. And I remember when the lease was up 5 years ago, the community stepped forth and said that we're now an anchor, if you will, in the community, you know, in the neighborhood where we're located. And so all of those myths, if you will, those concerns have been removed. And so to me, those are two things that could be tremendously effective, you know, in terms of dealing with substance abuse and so on.
And on reentry, that, and Mike, it's your field. The substance abuse thing is, I've done hundreds and hundreds of driving unders, and there'll be an arrest at 2 a.m., and you say, what do you last remember? And the previous memory is about 8 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. I had a home invasion where the kid broke into two of his former classmates' apartment, and when the police arrived, they said, how do you know it was him? And the kids pulled out the yearbook and said, that's him right there. And then when they got a warrant, they went to where he ended up. He had no memory of what he did. He was a poly abuser, drugs and alcohol.
Yeah,
so
coke, right.
After incarceration, you need intense supervision, urines, that sort of thing. And again, like stressing it, jobs. You've got to focus their lives, give them a purpose. Because most folks, I think, are subject to redemption. They can get on the straight and narrow.
Let's go on to the next question, because I want to, again, honor your time with your questions and thoughts. So this question is directed to Maureen Walsh. You describe an encouraging picture of recent, quote-unquote, reentry developments. What will it take for those services to affect every discharged inmate? What are the barriers to them accessing those services?
Well, I think in part what we've seen today is a mindset change. We talked about a paradigm shift. And we have to recognize that this took years and years between sentencing philosophies and tough on crime philosophies and a number of fiscal constraints. So to some degree, I think I have to preach to myself that there needs to be a degree of patience. What will be required is that is to make a showing. And to require, for example, supervising agencies such as parole and probation, more accountability. And Secretary Burke has requested and required parole to show reductions in recidivism, and he's looking at the right factors. He's asking us to show how many people are you providing employment, how many people have stable housing, and how many people have access to health care. Knowing that those are three of the biggest factors, and it has to be transparent. It can't be hidden. And so once we focus on the right people, and again, it's been written and it's been said, I think the requirement to get to the next step is to put the burden of proving this on those who are given that opportunity to lead these agencies. If we have not one more penny spent or not one legislative change, I think there's a lot that can be done. The Department of Corrections is working on a common risk assessment tool. There's ways in which we can work with one another to have individuals go to lower security. But one thing that needs to be done, I'd suggest, is that there can be no more one-to-one-in-one-day sentence. That does nothing to benefit any one particular individual or entity in this room or in the community. That's happening in over 40% of the state offenders being sentenced. They have no opportunity, and Senator Creedon himself said, and I agree, many of these individuals are able to change if given the right tools. But when you give an offender a 10-to-10-in-one-day sentence, and this has nothing to do with legislatively required sentence, it has everything to do with decisions made by everyone at the table, it gives no hope, it gives no opportunity, and it gives very little chance for the Department of Corrections to have an immediate impact. The better the Department of Corrections and Houses of Corrections make these offenders, the better chance we have for providing a continuum. Because the other part of the equation is, if we continue to invest in the Department of Corrections, which we should, in the House of Corrections, but we don't have the system in place, the housing, the employment, et cetera, and the tools, it's a waste of resources.
Thank you. Yes.
Just want to make one quick comment. A couple of the comments have sort of been premised on the notion that we're going to do more for everybody or more for a lot. The reality of it is correctional resources are probably going to be fairly fixed in the short term. Mm-hmm. Given the economic downturn we're experiencing, there may be even cuts in correctional resources and in human services resources, as we had a few years back in most states. Therefore, the reality is probably going to be spending the same amount of money or less differently, which probably means under the NIC model, you've got to develop some very rational, evidence-based ways to reallocate what resources you have. So it's probably not going to be possible to develop a reentry system that spreads the wealth to all offenders and gives everybody more. It's going to be a matter of making some very tough, difficult, and hopefully rational and widely supported choices about focusing and targeting resources in different ways.
So with limited resources, where is the best return on your dollar? Next question. Where is probation and the judiciary? And how can the legislators here help us get them engaged in a change movement?
We've had some great dialogue with probation and the judiciary on these issues, and I don't know who asked the question and what prompted it, but I will tell you that they are not policy-making branches of government. The judiciary, as everybody knows, is looking to the legislature, and they interpret our intent, and obviously probation is following the edict to some degree of what we ask them to do in terms of changing statutes. The interesting thing about probation is I think that they have been doing an exceptional job throughout the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and because of the increased cry of the public, for example, to have better monitoring of certain offenders, we in the House just last week gave probation an additional $3.8 million, I believe, to allow them to have better GPS tracking. I think that's an indication to some degree of where the policy is on this. And as a quick digression to that question, I will point out that in order to develop the ability politically in the legislature to deal with some of these issues, what has been happening recently has been helpful. The Mass Bar Association, the Boston Bar Association, lawyers and nonprofits that are associated with these issues have been doing their very best to communicate to the local media and to the larger print media by writing op-ed pieces and by also being available in various communities to prompt these discussions, provide the other side of the story on a lot of these issues, and it has been extremely helpful. But in terms of probation and judiciary, if the question is why they aren't here on this panel this morning, I don't know. But certainly, I don't think it's lack of interest. I think that we have worked extremely well with probation and with the representatives from the judiciary.
Can do. Does anybody else, sir?
But I will mention, I appreciate that response, but as Senator Creedon said, it's very important that we have supervision for offenders, primarily within the first 2 years after they leave the system. Not all offenders are being paroled, so therefore, only the ones that are paroled will get that supervision, and many are discharging. So I believe that probation, with its resources and its wide responsibility, perhaps need to take a different look at how it's doing business, because someone needs to be responding to that need that exists. That is, the large number of offenders leaving our system without supervision, because we know the data shows that offenders that reoffend usually reoffend within the first 2 years, and then the reoffending falls off beyond that point. So we need to perhaps have a more serious conversation with probation as to rethinking how we're doing business today to make sure that those offenders who are not being paroled are also receiving some degree of supervision as they discharge more assistance.
Can do. Is anybody else who would like to respond? Oh, yes, sir.
Just in terms of, and I think Gene was correct, we have a good relationship with the judiciary and with probation, but this is anecdotal, but the other day walking back from the district court, I was thinking about one of the staffers in Ways and Means wanted us to eliminate the crime of disturbance, the statutory crime of, you know, railers and brawlers, and then operating uninsured. I said, why do you want to do that? And the young lady said, well, we want to reduce the amount of money in the budget that we have to give to the Committee for Public Counsel Service. And that was a way of doing it. And I said, well, years ago we eliminated the crime of drunkenness, and it was well-intended. And we put in place thereof protective custody. Now, when I was in law school, I spent 3 summers in Mikestown, Hyannis, Barnesville, as a police officer. And problematic people we could take in for drunkenness, and in the morning when they sober, they didn't even go to court and get arraigned. They signed a release, and they left. And that was, like, for example, abusive spouses and what have you, bang, locked them up. On the way back from court thinking of this, there was a police officer at a construction site, and a fellow staggering down the street, staggering around the policeman, went over to one of those trash receptacles to hold himself up. The policeman just ignored it. So oftentimes the unintended consequences of well-thought-out legislation, and again, we're getting back to your area, Michael, of substance abuse, it's rampant. And I think the courts want to help, but we've all got to do this together as a team. We can't have these silos. We got probation here and legislators there and judiciary there. But as Gene points out, I think we do carry that conversation on in this state anyway.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner, you want to respond, and then we'll go to the next question?
Certainly. That's a perfect example. The PC law is something that we struggle with every single day. There was a move to put that, make it non-criminal, but put it under the supervision of the police. But we have a situation now where the captains who are running the lockup facilities don't want to have to deal with the medical issues that are inherent and the psych issues that are inherent. It's not only the PC law, but they also deinstitutionalized the mental health facilities. And so all of it came back to us. And there were no resources to weed out people who were truly sick, and so as a default now, everybody goes to the emergency room, and it's costing millions and millions and millions of dollars every year in health costs because we can't get our hand around this problem as in the Commonwealth. So these are practical issues. That's what I mean about this. And we just need to be continually updating them and paying attention to them so that we're doing the most cost-effective solution that we can come up with.
Okay. Next question. How do you prepare an inmate for reentry when he has spent virtually all his sentence in solitary confinement, 50% of the inmates in segregation are mentally ill, compared to 25% at large.
Well, I'll try this one. First of all, I'm not sure that 50% of all the offenders in seg are mentally ill. I don't know where that figure came from. But I will tell you that we do not want to discharge offenders from seg back to the community. We all know what occurs then. So within the department, any good reentry program would have a step-down phase when you're stepping offenders down from seg to lower level facilities where they can access the treatments. That's the goal. The challenge is that, again, we need resources to implement those programs. We need resources to, in my estimation, build the capacity to respond to the deficits of the offenders. And I don't believe that today we have that ability within our system. But that is part of our reentry plan within the DOC. We're looking at how we are going to go about stepping those persons down from SEG to lower level facilities where they can access services, because to discharge them, we all know, from SEG to the community serves no one's best interest.
Very good. Yes, sir.
Yes, Tom. First of all, I think we should be clear and appreciate that there's been progress made in dealing with the mentally ill that are in county jails and state prisons. And I just wanted to applaud the senator and representative, because I can remember back in 1975 when the consent decree went into effect, and we're supposed to have set up this, quote, model of community mental health, and a lot of these services weren't in place, and so they would end up at the county jail. And I always remember feeling so inadequate because the lack of training and resources at that particular time. We saw, if you will, the decompensation as sort of a disruptive aspect that would occur, and we would exacerbate the mental illness. And today, with partnerships with Behavioral Health Network, for example, in Hampden County in the Springfield area, we have received, you know, $1.3 million. Okay? So, again, if one could imagine that if a correctional officer, and again, I emphasize that correctional officer versus a guard, recognizes that there is a mental problem, he can call upon the services of a mental health technician to come into the unit to evaluate that particular person, and then they're placed into what we call a respite or evaluation stabilization unit that occurs. And but again, we have that partnership with the mental health folks, and I can remember some years ago this funding was cut out, and we felt we were going back to the old days again in terms of just warehousing, but that's not the case today. And also, this again is where we get into what I see effective public policy in terms of the regionalization of these specialized services, such as we have regional services now for women, training, substance abuse, and these kind of things. And my way of thinking, this is a good policy and good direction. And I know in Western Mass, with a handshake with the four Western Mass sheriffs, we have this in effect, and I'm really proud of my brother sheriffs in this regard.
Yep. Moving on, how can we engage both the media and business leaders to embrace this notion, to encourage spending for necessary programs, and agree to employ and hire returning offenders?
We needed somebody from the Chamber of Commerce on the panel.
I do feel that, and this is why I feel the stars are lined up right, is that, you know, again, and certainly our legislators see this occurring, and certainly the governor, you know, on one hand, trying to raise revenues and so on, is that, in my opinion, at least in our county, we have dealt with the Chamber of Commerce. And in fact, I can recall back when I first came in back 33 years ago, there was a collaboration, a partnership with the Chamber, and they had a very enlightened administrator at the time. But again, excuse me, must be my lovely wife wondering where I have been. I've been gone for 24
bring them
hours.
Home, you know, tonight. Okay.
Probably thinks I'm at Wonderland or something like that. But But no, so again, the business community, in my opinion, sees the tremendous cost being directed, and in behalf of public safety, because again, I think we talk about all of us, we have to get out and we have to talk to business people. And I know in our county, I feel very blessed that they recognize this, and what I have to do is keep, if you will, building bridges. I see Dave Sullivan here, and I know Dave's been a big help to working with Rich Devine and our, if you will, our workforce in terms of getting out into the community. And I would say this, too, is that who would ever think today that we have housing specialists and we have job developers, okay, working for a sheriff's department, you know. And but anyways, I would just like to say that's why I think people are seeing that the idea about just locking them up and throw away the key today, in my opinion, is not the case. And this is why I think this is a great time for change. And the change is certainly we need to take some small steps here that I think can be taken, because people recognize that substance abuse, mental health, and safety is such a key issue. And I think they're there. You know, we get, and certainly this panel is an example of this, and all the people that believe that.
I mean, it also occurs to me that you need to kind of replicate forums like this at the local level. I mean, you know, if all, you know, I always say all prevention is local, and part of what we have are kind of community-based coalitions that actually highlight those kinds of issues at the local level. And so I think that having a panel like this, primarily at the local level, I think can serve a great purpose in terms of doing a better job at educating and increasing awareness around what the significant issues are.
This is going to be the last written question, then, because I also want to respect the time where, you know, people want to make comment. And this was, so now what? We have several studies that provide both analysis and roadmaps for change in practice and policies in Massachusetts. The numbers of incarcerated show us that we must act or pay in human and financial cost. Who here will lead the charge and coordinate systematic change in our state policies? Do we really lack the political will to implement evidence-based practices and change our ways to improve public safety and reduce barriers to success? And will the legislators support the efforts? We have the dialogue. Where's the real continuum of care? It is not new money, simply a reinvestment of existing resources. Comments? Sure.
The moderator has asked me just to stay for this one.
I should have ducked out.
I have to go to a meeting dealing with fees at registries of deeds. If we don't pass legislation, Gene and I don't do this, we're going to lose $19.6 million, so I've got to attend to that. But on this point, and I don't mean to put the secretary on the spot, but I'm repeating myself, but you do have a governor and a secretary who like to work. And they are aware of this problem. And they are that's the executive branch. And I certainly, and I know my co-chair is impressed by their work ethic, and we want to work with them to accomplish the ends we talked about today. I think we understand what the problem is, and I think we know what direction we have to go in. And Gene and I want to go in that direction, and I think we've got the leadership that will take us there.
That's tremendous.
And now off to the Registry of Deeds.
Thank you, sir.
Go save our money.
This was interesting. That's boring and arcane.
Other comments?
If I could just follow up on what the senator said. It's not any one individual legislator, for example, that doesn't want to, I think, in a collective way, solve a problem. The issue is very different where I work in the House, where you have to build consensus. And even if you have the leadership, even if you have the vision, we have to deal with the practical issues that are brought to us by the members. And I have to tell you that there is a prevailing sentiment in discussing these issues, a nervousness on behalf of the legislators to ever be perceived as being soft on crime. So that is why both the senator and I in our respective chambers have been dealing with these issues for some time. I do agree with Sheriff Ash that I think there is a confluence available for us currently
to be a little bold, and I think we're working on that. What I think is most essential to developing the political will is having the support not only in the community, but also through the nonprofits that I referenced, as well as the bar associations and the other entities out there that deal with this issue. And I think we need their assistance in educating the public that without focusing on anything specific in front of us, but generally what we've been talking about today, that this is the direction we need to go in. These are the ideas we need to explore for all of the reasons mentioned, that it will save us money in the long run. It will build and make our community stronger. It's an issue and a problem that can't be swept under the rug. And I think if we have those things working in tandem, that will make it easier for that political will and that political leadership to develop.
Thank you, sir. Please.
I would like to add that the data is already available to us. You don't have to go out there and search for the data. I agree that it's just a matter of making presentations to the legislature and to partners in the community that can forward this initiative. And that's one thing that we would like to do within the DOC. And quite frankly, right now, we are working and putting together a presentation to share with the Secretary, and with the Secretary's blessings, then take that to a wider audience to start showing the benefits of evidence-based interventions.
Fantastic. We have 10 minutes left. So, I apologize. Yes, Mark. Yes, sir.
Could I just make one comment with respect to the question from the viewpoint of the NIC transition from prison to community initiative model? Under that model, NIC expected that what would happen is that there would emerge within a particular state a champion, and that would probably be an agency head, often corrections, but not necessarily corrections, who would see the wisdom of this approach and who would sort of become the spark plug to stir the water to get other people similarly situated interested. But the next step was to get them to be specifically authorized and empowered by the governor being the person that basically selected them and appointed them and gave them their tenure, basically. So that the idea was to have the initial work to occur at the agency head level, but then have the governor provide a very specific mandate and authorization for the appropriate agency heads to collaborate together, and that's worked out very well in states like Missouri and Michigan, where the governor has been very, very forcefully and actively involved in moving this forward.
Thank you. Stopping there, again, is there anybody in the audience that would like to